Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to yet another episode of Bilge Pumps. They haven't yet hung, drawn, quartered, or tarred or feathered us. Possibly because government restrictions mean they can't come in groups of more than six, but there you go. We are joined this week, as usual, by myself, Drac, that is Trickin' Info, and we have Dr. Alexander Clark of AC underscore Naval History, and Jamie Seedle of Armoured Carriers. Remind me again, which episode are we on? I know we're in the
20.
Double. 20. Oh, 20.
Mm. Yeah. So we're still a new podcast series as far as I'm concerned. I'm not changing this till 25. Till we get to episode 25, then I also have to say we are cannot say we are your new easy listening naval maritime affairs podcast series.
So our podcast is not quite yet allowed to drink in some US states.
No.
But can vote and join the army.
And pay tax.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you can always pay tax. The Income Removal Service will see to that. I'm pretty sure they put a tax on being born if they could figure out how. Oh, dear. So, what is our subject of discussion today? I think we were going to talk about something called the Manhattan Project, but not the one from 1945.
No, it's the new one. Basically, the U.S. Navy has decided that their new communications project and their new communications infrastructure is their next generation of Manhattan Project.
And that, to me, immediately rings alarm bells. When any form of bureaucracy or even private business, for that matter, comes up with a name like Sputnik Moment or Moonshot, or Manhattan Project, you know there's trouble afoot.
Yeah, well, it usually means someone's been spending too much time sitting in a focus group and then couldn't come up with anything other than let's recycle an old name, some idea that they've got far too much time on their hands or far too little in the brain cell department when it comes to coming up with cool names.
It could be worse. They could have just copied the British name for its communication system.
Yes.
Skynet.
Yeah, that has a certain ring to it. I mean, especially as we've been talking about in other episodes, given that the future seems to be either semi or fully automated, the point at which we give Skynet command of a large fleet of heavily armed drones, I mean, we have a documentary saying why this is a bad idea, but I don't think that's going to stop anyone actually doing it.
Yeah. To me, the whole... Look, I'm cynical. I'm a journalist. I'm cynical, of course. So whenever you hear a grand, ambitious name like, you know, Manhattan Project or Moonshot or Sputnik Moment, you immediately get images in one's head of, yep, here we are.
Colossal failure?
we've got someone sitting back on their, in their office, saying, we need to pick a winner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And usually it means you go and do it. And I'll take the credit and you can take the fall.
You usually find the meeting minutes are full of all the terms I absolutely detest. Like, we're going to go on a journey. It's like, no, you're in a seat around a table. No one is going on a journey unless it's out the window. I swear if I hear another one of those terms in any work-related meeting again, I will try and punch someone through the internet.
Okay, so cynicism aside, what do we think about a fully networked force?
Oh, it has... I can kind of see where they're coming from. Because if you've got a fully networked force, then effectively you no longer have, let's say, a battle group, a carrier battle group. You have a single war offensive entity that just happens to have many limbs and many ways of making things go away in clouds of explosive shrapnel, which is a good thing. And it means for example, and I know some of this capability already exists, but in a fully networked environment, it would mean that in theory, you could have, let's say, your radar picket, whether that be an AWACS or an outlying ship or both, on the vector of threat, and every single ship that has weapons that can reach that way, that or that far, can start assisting in the defense of the entire group directed by a single vessel. And if that single vessel sensors might not be up to the task under a fully networked solution, you might actually have the flagship doing the network and vectoring whilst the picket provides the sensor data and all the other ships in the fleet provide your actual weapons payload, which is all good. And if you've got a large number of sort of dedicated drones, then even better. The only problem really that I have with it, which is a rather major one, is that it assumes your kind of perfect sandbox thinking of, yes, if everything works perfectly and to plan, we will be fine, and doesn't really stop to consider that the enemy has a vote as well.
The enemy has lots of votes. And also, the biggest thing, which I find annoying when I'm talking about this, is I'm here about this. Damn, we already developed this for the F-35. Isn't this what the F-35 was entirely built around?
It is the F-35, but I suspect they must have they've had a bit of practice with it now and decided they like it and want to extend it beyond that weapon system.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is,
I was just going to say, what was the quote you had there, Dr. Clark, from the Admiral making the announcement?
Oh, yes. And I have to say, this comes from the lovely article written by David Larter, who does... I really enjoy his articles, which he does for Defence News. Anyway, the Navy's ability to establish and sustain sea control in the future is at risk, Gilday said in his letter. I am confident that closing this risk is dependent on enhancing distributed maritime operations for a teamed, manned, unmanned force that exploits artificial intelligence and machine learning. I'm not confident we are building the naval operational architecture connecting and enabling this future as force as quickly as we must. The thing I would point out is any chief of the naval staff from Britain, America, anywhere could have written that sentence for the last 30 years. Think about it.
And I think they actually have.
Yes, I think every one of them has written that.
The problem is, of course, is the pace of change means that the definition of your network force keeps changing and expanding. So, you know, now you've got a situation where every ship in the fleet can provide input for that missile that's flying, you know, towards the enemy. Now you've got a situation where the entire fleet can get instantaneous information from the Triton loitering over the horizon, giving you a picture of what's going on around you. There's a whole lot of electricity flashing through the air, keeping these very hungry, information-hungry pieces of technology fed.
But surely the problem is we're going to end up with so much information going through the air, we're either going to overload the systems or we're going to have more information than we have missiles.
Well, I think that the single largest problem you're going to have with this is that if you're using it as a force multiplier, which is effectively what it is, you're going to start then basing your engagement scenarios around we need to meet X force with Y force, and your Y force that you send in is going to be the sum total of its components. So that's going to be your ships, your carriers, your subs, etc., etc., including your network warfare capability. And you'll go, okay, well, that's adequate. We've got X percent theoretical superiority over the enemy force, even though we've got fewer ships because we have this wonderful system, etc., etc., except for the small problem that every single war from the age of sail, probably earlier, all the way through to the Falklands has shown us that communications systems are the single most vulnerable point of attack for practically any combatant, whether they be First World, Second World, or Third World. And sometimes it can even be your own systems that end up messing with you.
Classic case being HMS Sheffield.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just serious. And the thing is, okay, so you're going to have this network sort of force. You either have to depend upon satellites, in which case you make satellites the number one target for taking them out in war, in any moment war begins. And I'm sorry. Those people go, but no, no one will hit satellites because you'll hit, they will hit theirs as well. That might be the case, but if they design their force around the ability to survive with the satellites knocked out, and you haven't, or you're going to depend upon the only communication system which can begin to deal that data flow they're talking about, laser-based communications. And that means you're within visual range again of your ships.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is, if you've got the capability there, then yeah, it should probably be developed, but I really wouldn't I wouldn't stake the future on it. It would be kind of what I'd call, if you're thinking in terms of a single person, it would, fully networked force should be like the utility knife that a soldier carries. It's a useful tool. You don't want to be without it. It has certain functions, which are pretty good, pretty useful. But you don't go into a fight thinking, ah, yes, well, it's just as well I have my utility knife, and if I don't have it, we're going to lose. That's what you have your rifle and your grenades and your your communication system to summon the airstrikes, etc., etc., etc. If you move that to the point of this is now central to our combat doctrine, then it means that the instant someone worked out how to jam it, disrupt it, break it, or whatever, you are now at a massive disadvantage, which is never going to end well.
Yeah, I guess the pressure to go down this path is the speed of modern combat, really, isn't it? If you've got a hypersonic missile coming in at you, then you'd just simply be able to do everything for in a flash. You've got to detect its course, speed, trajectory, and then you've got to share that with everyone instantaneously, and then you have to do the calculations of how to intercept that or evade that instantaneously, and then you've got to distribute that instantaneously. So there's that very important component right there. But as you say, once again, that communication, that processing power becomes your weak point. I'm just reminded of Operation Pedestal, the Malta convoy, where the two British fleet carriers got the convoy up to the edge of the Sicilian Channel with hardly a loss. Had to leave the convoy behind because they didn't want to, go into the Narrows themselves. Left it in the hands of a very strong escort force, including two cruisers outfitted for fighter control. Both those cruisers get sunk, and the Spitfires and Beaufighters from Malta were completely useless because they weren't able to be directed to intercept the incoming air attacks. So, if you've got this central command ship operating and controlling all of its semi-manned, unmanned vessels around it, and that one command ship has some sort of failure, whether it's enemy-induced or internally-induced breakdown, then all of a sudden, what have you got? You've got a whole lot of aluminium floating on the sea surface, thinking what comes next.
I think this is the base problem you're dealing with, because you've got two options. You can either go internet style, where there are so many nodes it's almost impossible to take down, in which case every ship, every aircraft has to be able to be a command node, which is also going to be incredibly expensive and even more complicated to implement. Or you go to route where you have the scenario Jamie's suggesting, where you make a ship the number one target.
Yeah, look, you know, I just keep thinking of your notion of unhackable semaphore flags. But let's face it, you know, that's not going to work against a hypersonic missile.
I don't know. Have one flag which comes up, which has a very fast missile look picture on it. This comes up. We've got a hypersonic inbound. Everyone fire everything into the air now.
I guess the other element of this is you know, just how advantageous is this networking ability? I know that it's been the core of the F-35 program from pretty much the outset. It was very much a part of the whole marketing campaign, you know, with Lockheed's glossy videos on YouTube. It's something that has gone quiet since the aircraft is up and out there, but I think it's more to do with the fact that, you know, they don't want to tell everyone just how this system works and how effective it is and the likes. But, you know, it's that leaves people such as you and me thinking, well, you know, what's the product here? What's the outcome here? And is that outcome worth the input and worth the risk? And until we learn more about the ability of, you know, a handful of F-35s basically to fly as though they were one machine and act in perfect unison, like you know, those swimming dancers, then you know, we're probably going to be left speculating about these things.
And to be fair, in the first time ever that Bill Trunks can say this, we can say, tune in next week to possibly learn the answer to this, because we have Steve George coming on, who is a gentleman I was introduced to by Michael Clapp several years back. He was an air engineer in the Falklands War, did brilliant work on that, and when he eventually retired from the Royal Navy, became the go-to consultant for pretty much every major aero firm in the world. When they have one of those problems which the computer says this will work, but we're not sure, we need someone to come in who can figure this out. And he even worked on the F-35. So, Jamie's going to be having fun because me and Drac are going to be trying to ask Steve questions about the Falklands War. And Jamie's got a whole burgeoning heap of them on the F-35.
Yeah, look, I think I might just whittle it down to a couple, and we'll have to try and convince him to come back one day for a F-35 special.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's I think it's one of these things where, as I say, it's you definitely don't want to not have it. And the advantages of such a network are obvious. My concern is twofold. One is that, again, if you're going up against countries that have literally no hope of disrupting your network, you probably don't need the network in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like going up against, like, the more recent edition of the Gulf War in the early 2000s. Sort of, yes, you had the B-2s and the B-1s and all the other, I think the F-117 was still flying at that point, but did you need them really? You could have knocked it, to be honest, you could have knocked Iraq's defenses over with F-15s and B-52s alone.
And you could have reactivated half your museum aircraft to take out Afghanistan's.
Yeah. For all the air defense that Afghanistan has, you might as well have co-opted the various flying museum B-17s for all the air defense they would have been able to put up. So against those kind of enemies, then the network, I guess the network stuff makes you more cost effective because you can do slightly more with fewer ships. But it's not going to, it's just a nice design feature at that point. Whereas if you're going to take it take it up against an enemy who actually matters, an enemy where you actually legitimately need the force multiplier that the networking, full networking represents, chances are that's also an enemy who has the capability of just taking out your network, or at least severely disrupting it. And
who will design their forces to do so?
Yeah, and that leads me to my second concern, which is more to do with the political side of things, because if you now have a fully networked force, or plans for a fully networked force, and you're saying, well, yeah, all of these ships can do this, this, and this, that is exactly when you're going to hear politicians going, well, if we're going to be designing, a long-distance, like, outer perimeter radar picket that's effectively a floating Spy 6 or something like that, with an engine attached to it, does your next generation destroyer really need to have its own radar array? And does your floating radar picket really need to have anything in the form of long-range defensive weaponry? Because that's going to be handled by the arsenal ship, or honestly, not an arsenal ship that's floating around behind, and so on and so on and so forth. At which point you'll start to see capabilities from ships being deleted, because on cost reasons, they're not necessary, because they're redundant, because the fully networked force will take care of it all. And then...
You mean like Albion and Bulwark lost their helicopter hangar, their gym, their heart medical facilities, because there would always be four aviation ships to guarantee there was a ship available, and there would always be HMS Argus, because there would always be a replacement hospital ship. And all these things?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure that wouldn't happen again, yeah.
Trak. Never.
This level of cynicism you have.
I'm infecting you all, aren't I?
Yeah. And then, well, to be honest, we're British. Cynicism is like, if you cut us in half, cynical and sarcasm are the two semicircular words that you'll find engraved. Like a stick of particularly fleshy rock. Let's not go down that line. But anyway, yeah.
You and I are going to get into trouble if I keep using various food analogies to describe things. People don't understand how serious food is in the UK. To use food matters.
Mm. I mean, to be honest, half the empire was founded on the search for new and interesting things to eat.
Yeah.
But yes, it's sort of like, yeah, if I can see politicians in all sorts of places, and let's face it, with the long and storied history of the US Congress trying to strangle the US Navy in its crib, definitely Congress will try and pull this kind of stuff. And as Dr. Clark has alluded to, that we've already got experience of that in the UK. And yeah, that'll save a few dollars here and there. And then when you end up in an actual war, as I said, if there's any kind of disruption to that network, you will suddenly have ships that can see the enemy coming and can do nothing about it, and ships that could blow the enemy out of the water but are completely blind. And that's at that point, it'll be the poor old, it will almost be like a movie trope, some poor old retired captain who's 2 months from retirement, sailing at the back in a clapped-out Arleigh Burke that's due to be decommissioned at the end of this voyage, is the only ship with the full spectrum of capabilities and ends up either being the only survivor or the one who has to save the day, depending on which particular line of movie tropes we're going down.
I'm going to go for only survivor, I'm afraid, in that scenario.
Look, again, it's so easy to be cynical. So, you know, again, trying to be optimistic here, what would be the inspiring this admiral and every other admiral to go down this path? What is it that is
because
it
just purely... sounds great?
Yeah,
because I think in the modern world where technology seems to be the world's savant, it sounds amazing to keep talking about new technology.
Yeah,
but is this a case of Drax thinking where, you know, if the opposition has it, then you have to have it yourself. So I'm thinking that it might be all well and good to be very cynical about it, but if your opponent's got it, then you're either going to have to develop you're going to have to develop a countermeasure to it, but it's also going to be smart to have it yourself.
Yeah. I think you're going to have to have both sides of the coin, and to say it will have advantages when they can be used. So I'm not saying it's a completely useless idea. It's just they've got to be incredibly careful to make sure that it's not something they're going to rely on. And I think this is why my initial gut reaction to the headline of sort of calling it a Manhattan Project just makes me put my head in my hands, because if you're going to develop this, for all the reasons we've gone over, it's the kind of system you want to have, but you don't want to make a big deal out of. Because if you were to sell it as the next generation of upgraded network communications equipment, and if you're in front of a congressional hearing, you say, well, look, we've already got this capability to a certain extent. It allows our ships to talk to each other, so it enhances our combat capabilities a bit. And we just need to move it on to the next generation because we've got all these sorts of weapons, new weapon systems and new aircraft and ships, and they need to talk to each other.
We have to integrate the F-35. We have to integrate new submarines, all these things. Yeah,
exactly. You'll get exactly the same capability, but people aren't going to be then cutting the capabilities of all your new ships in because they think it's the be-all and end-all. They'll just think it's effectively an upgraded comm system. And that means you'll have all that capacity, but you'll also have ships that can fight on their own. To be honest, the other thing that does, before we go on to some more positives, the other thing that does make me slightly worried is that every time there's a new form of communications system or upgraded form of communication system, the Admiralty, of whichever navy is in question, always tries to micromanage via that communication system, and it never works.
Can you imagine Churchill in command with one of these things?
Well, we know how well that worked out when he was just at the planning stage of things.
Yes, that would be the point at which Cunningham would be having a lot of communications difficulties. Oh, what are you saying? What are you saying, Winston? I can't quite hear you. There appears to be chatter on the net.
Where's that lovely chap from the Free Polish Navy? Congratulations, you've now been promoted to Chief Radio Officer. What do you mean you don't speak English? Fantastic. Lock him in the room. Yeah. I mean, you look, it's like the Age of Sail. Everyone had independence. Then someone figured out they could use brigs and sloops to send communications. And all of a sudden, there were dozens of brigs and picket sloops in the Navy shuttling orders back and forth like a kind of demented naval postal service. And then eventually,
hey, those brigs and sloops were also used for convoy escorts.
Yes, which is probably about the only real use they had. You look at this, like the number of Royal Navy officers in that period who suddenly got incredibly adept at evading their own forces. and then towards the end of the 19th century, you had the telegraph system, and then all of a sudden, orders could be, instead of spending weeks at sea, you could send the orders directly to a land base. And then you could radio out messages or send messages via hired picket ships, etc., to your various forces. And again, the micromanagement came back. And then again, all the various Navy officers suddenly developed fantastical reasons as to why they could never approach shore. And then long distance radio was finally fitted to ships, and everybody kind of held their heads in their hands. And to be fair, I'm relatively certain there's a good chunk of the reason why Jellicoe said use radio as minimal as possible and as low power as possible was to try and avoid the Admiralty sending him micromanaging instructions every day of the week. It just goes on and on and on. So if you've got a fully networked force, the other thing you can guarantee is some bigwig in Whitehall or Washington or Moscow or Beijing is going to sit there and go, right, bring me one of those futuristic-looking command and control rooms from the movies where I have a massive 3D screen in the middle of the room and I can see everything that's going on, and I will command the battle because I have the four stars on my shoulders and I will lead our forces into combat from half the planet away.
You mean like they tried in the Falklands War with Norwood?
Yes.
And that was so great.
That worked really well.
Because please, before our listeners sort of start talking to me about and sending the details about Sandy Woodward being the task force commander, he wasn't. Sandy Woodward was a task group commander, as was Michael Clapp, who we've had on here, and Julian Thompson. Task force commander was back in the UK. And the thing was, the reason the task force commander was back in the UK was because they didn't want to send Vice Admiral Derek Reffel down there, because if he was down there, they felt it would make the war too big a thing. So instead, a four-star, and I'm trying to remember which one of the admirals it was who actually gave himself the title of task force commander, but there were a few who were going around who were basically trying to act like it. I think it was... I have a feeling it was... memory. My better half, my girlfriend, would kill me right now.
Well, we're going to be doing a special on Falklands at some point anyway, so we'll revisit that one.
It wasn't Leech, it was the other one, who I keep forgetting. But, yeah. And it was... there's a four-star basically sitting in Northwood, sending out orders. And I think one of the classic things is Michael Clapp said said that he received an order once, which was ordering him to do something by a certain date, and the ship no longer was his command orbit, and B, he received the order 2 days after the date had passed that it was supposed to be enacted by, and 4 days after the ship was no longer under his command, was now part of Sandy's command. So you sit there and go, not because they didn't have the communications technology. They had SATCOMs, and all these things were starting to come in, and they weren't really great, but they started to come in. But because it was considered such a low priority message, it got lost at the various stages in the traffic, so it didn't get received by Michael until...
Yes, and it's probably wrong anyway.
5G will solve all these bandwidth problems.
Assuming Huawei doesn't just relay everything straight back to Beijing.
That is what is behind all of this, is the potential of 5G, of course. The ability to just pump so much information out there that bandwidth no longer becomes a problem. And at that point, you're thinking, what's the next problem going to be? Mm. And I guess that's what this discussion is all about, is that there's always a new problem that comes along, and that problem is always unanticipated and always emerges right at the time you don't want it to.
I think, to be honest, the other thing is what happens to MCON, because as anyone who serves in any in modern Navy will tell you, ships can have 2, 3, 4 major radar arrays, multiple communication systems, and various other forms of electronically emitting sensor and receiving systems. And if they're going on a proper exercise, or they're thinking about going into a war footing, pretty much everything gets shut down, up to and including the navigational radars, because every single stray emission that you're putting out is a chance for the enemy to find you way, way, way past where you can detect them, thanks to that wonderful inverse square law. And, yeah, you've got all this wonderful equipment, but you're only ever going to turn it on when you're actually in the process of having to repel an attack. Whereas if you are a fully networked Navy, unless you want to shut that off and make yourself a non-networked Navy, which kind of defeats the entire point, you are going to be broadcasting to literally everybody with an electronic antenna on that side of the planet. Oh, look, I'm over here. And in an era when, oh, look, I'm over here, might see a bunch of DF-21 ballistic missiles coming at you, it's not necessarily the wisest course of action.
Is it a wise course of action in the next step, which is, well, actually, we know that all of our ships are going to be located. Mm. We know that all of our ships are going to be tracked. We know that we can't hide them because the satellites are swarming and the drones are flying. Therefore, we need the ability to... we still need the ability to move our ships from point A to point B through contested waters. Mm. So we need to be able to defend them as best we can, because we know we can't hide them.
Yeah, and I think this is where the positives come in. As long as it works, it would be a huge force multiplier. And it would allow for things like the Arsenal ship to become viable. It would allow you to have the more classic defensive circle rather than some of the defensive formations that you have to put into place now. It would allow you to say, for example, to have your ASW frigates in a very wide sweep to sanitize a very large area of ocean from enemy submarines well away from your task force. And then they wouldn't be at the kind of risk they would be now, because most of those ships have a self-defense capability. They don't have a long-range anti-aircraft warfare capability for the most part, unless you're the US Navy, which currently just uses the Burke for literally everything. But it would mean you could have those forces operating out there, and then if an incoming attack develops...
In their defense, they are now building some frigates.
Yes, yeah. And this is the thing. Once those frigates are out there, it would mean it doesn't matter. If an enemy tries to snipe off that frigate, effectively that frigate has the full resources of every destroyer and cruiser in the fleet 50, 100 miles back to call on to defend itself, which is fantastic. So you get better and more
survival missiles.
Yeah. Yeah, but yeah, at that point you get better ASW defense and a more survivable ASW screened at the same time. Likewise, assuming that you have ASROC or some variant thereof, or a bunch of very active helicopters or whatever, or maybe even a successor to the S3 Viking, who knows, then if a submarine slips through the screen and it gets picked up on the sonar of one of your anti-aircraft warfare destroyers, which maybe isn't the best well-equipped to deal with it, you can have a response from your ASW side very quickly, because they know as soon as that destroyer knows. And so on and so on and so forth. And even when it comes down to the sort of the niche cases, let's say you've sent out your aircraft to do their carrier strike, they're coming back, however many have survived. Some of them are damaged, some of them are running out of fuel, etc., etc., and some of them aren't going to make it back to the carrier. But if one of them, say, gets to 50 miles from the carrier, spots a friendly ship, pilot hits eject, then as long as he's done that within sensor distance of that friendly ship, it doesn't matter if that friendly ship is a drone sensor platform, a supply ship, a destroyer, a frigate, or whatever, everyone else in the fleet immediately knows, pilot down in that location, search and rescue is on its way. So there are all of these advantages to it, as long as the system works.
Just at this point, I have to ask one very quick question. How often do you have to reset your Wi-Fi?
I don't tend to use the Wi-Fi too much, because I don't trust it for pretty much that reason. All of my electronics stuff is all plugged into physical Ethernet cables, with the sole exception of the printer, because it doesn't have an Ethernet port, and I can't be bothered to try and retro install one, because it's only a 40 quid printer I got from Tesco.
Well, I've got kids, and they all want to use the internet wherever they are in the house and in the yard. So I mean, I know this isn't the same technology, I know it's not 5G, but you know, on a rainy day, one of the kids will come from the other end of the house and say, I can't get the I can't watch Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
So
I have Wi-Fi everything, if that, and sort of in like at the moment, because as you know, my house wasn't set up for the offices at all. It was entirely set up as just our home, so we just needed Wi-Fi because we had the hardwire Ethernet at work. I'm now sort of slowly installing it, and it's planned for the garden offices when they come. But we have Wi-Fi everything, including Wi-Fi security cameras. And if you want to overload Wi-Fi, you just start off with the security cameras. And it's not a lot of cameras. I don't have oodles and oodles, although every time Drac drops off a book at my house, he does try to be Secret Service agent and not get spotted by them. Mm-hmm. And every time I almost feel like saying, because when I look back later, and I see him coming in, I'm sort of tempted to go, you do realize how many cameras are watching the front of the house, Drac. there are enough that they will spot you. But it's still it's a case of it's very easy to overload Wi-Fi and wireless.
Yeah.
Well, again, I guess the point is more the fact that they've obviously overcome that problem with the 5G. But for me, it's just the matter of getting components to talk to each other and then keep talking to each other. That there's always a connection that drops out. There's always a, you know, some sort of a ghost in the machine that means that, no, you're going to go and press that power button on the modem for 10 seconds and, you know, restart the whole process. And I just don't think that, it doesn't have that sort of, if you don't have that fundamental rock solid reliability, then it's always going to let you down when you need it the most. And it's, and
you mean when someone's actively trying to stop it working?
Yeah, I was going to say that's without someone actively trying to break it.
And look, again, I'm sure that, you know, the engineers, technicians, scientists working on this are well aware of that. But
are they though?
Yeah, for an ignoramus like myself, I'm always wondering, you know, just how often does that flight of F-35s ever actually get to fly in a fully connected, you know, mode? How often does every cog in that component work perfectly? And of course, that we will never know, because that's going to have to necessarily be top secret.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. It's like you'd hope that the people who are designing these systems take all this kind of stuff into account, but I'm just very conscious of look at almost every major war that's been fought in the 20th century. If you look at World War II, Vietnam, Korea, even to a certain degree, and also if you're talking about wars, quote unquote, the Cold War, both during those conflicts the enemy showed up with a lot of very nasty surprises that for both sides, where the planners on whichever respective side, which, as you say, you'd think they'd have thought about all of these things because they seem obvious in retrospect, but they hadn't for whatever reason, and they were left sort of holding the can going, that was unexpected, now everything's on fire. And in the Cold War, if you look at a lot of the estimates as to things like Soviet capabilities on our side of things, and obviously, well, don't really know that much about the Russian side of things. I'm sure someone from Russia could probably fill in from their side. But I know on the NATO side of things, there was a lot of, we have X percentage technological superiority or X percentage armor superiority or gun superiority or missile superiority or whatever. Basically, there was this whole perception of NATO forces have a definite and significant technological advantage across the board against the Russian forces. Then we started to get actual Russian issue tech showing up in the West during the 90s. And in an awful lot of cases, everyone sat back and went, they weren't stupid. That they actually have some pretty decent stuff. Okay, maybe some of it is technologically somewhat behind ours, but
it's not as far behind as we were banking on it being.
Yeah, yeah, and there was stuff in which the Russian stuff was just flat out superior. I mean, if you look at what's it called? I can never remember what the NATO designation is, but the Russian equivalent of the Sidewinder, their short range heat seeking air to air missile. They compared it to the current model of the Sidewinder, and the Russian model was just flat out superior. To the extent
the infrared tracking systems were also better.
And to the extent that I think the AAM, the Advanced Short Range Air to Air Missile, and the next generation of Sidewinder, they were specifically built to counter that missile once they had evidence for it. But those missiles didn't come into service for 10, 15 years after the Russian one had come into service. And it's the same thing, even with stuff like space exploration after the shuttle came into service and the moon landings. It was like, yes, well, America has won the space race. American space technology clearly superior. Then the Russians started selling flights on Soyuz, on the old Proton rockets, and selling the advanced rocket engines they built in the 80s. And it's only been in the past couple of years, so what we're talking, 30-odd years, 30-plus years, where something that the Russians cooked up in the late 70s, early 80s has been the top of the line as far as rocket engines were concerned. And they're only just getting past that now. So who knows what the Russians could have done if they'd had the past 30 years of proper development. But you get all these cases of people, and you sit back and in retrospect, you think, yeah, well, it's obvious the other side aren't going to be stupid. It's obvious the other side are going to develop down slightly different lines. It's obvious they're going to be better in some areas and worse in others. But it didn't occur to the people at the time. And
also, there is also this thing where you're looking back and people say things like, Ferry Fulmar.
Mm.
How often do I hear people going, oh, it's a terrible fight, a terrible fight, a terrible fight. And you look at it and actually look at the actual things, and this will probably start Jamie off.
Yeah.
But it's actually very good for what it's required to do and for what it actually does and for what it actually achieves and for what it's going up against when it is actually entering service. And this is the point about that technology. Sometimes I think some of the basis of our argument is our technology is better because by the time war happens, we'll have this in service, or we'll be able to put this in service. And you sit there and go, but what about today? Because there's always a lot of jam tomorrow. But unfortunately, the war doesn't come tomorrow. It always comes today. And the jam tomorrow isn't going to help me deal with the war today.
Yes, and there's a situation there where good enough is what was needed.
Yeah. And that's the Ferry Fulmar. Jamie, give us your few minutes or a couple of minutes on the Ferry Fulmar, because frankly, they deserve it. The listeners have to listen to me and Drac when we talk about our history passions. Go on, give them a couple of minutes.
Very, very simply, it's one of those situations where, you know, they came up with a fantastic new idea of a all bells, all whistles, multi-role aircraft in the Skua. This was supposed to be the bee's knees, but basically, even as they're starting to cut the very first metal, they realize, nope, sorry, the Skua is not going to live up to its promise. And, you know, somewhere along the line, fortunately, someone had the guts, I suppose, to admit that. So they initiated a crash course emergency fleet fighter program, and they looked at, you know, what they had available at the time. We're talking 1938 here. And Fairies had this prototype fast light bomber, which was a very much cut down kind of analog of the Fairy Battle, which the RAF had rejected because they decided they didn't like fast. They wanted big and heavy. The idea was that this light bomber could, with a few tweaks and modifications, be turned into a heavy fighter, which is exactly what the fleet air arm wanted. They wanted an aircraft that was capable of being a fighter, but was a fighter that was operating at sea, so therefore outside of the range of the then short-ranged ME-109s, and was more likely going to be up against things like the 110 and the Heinkel 111s. These were its foes. And it was supposed to be able to, in the pre-radar age, be able to fly for 6 hours without getting lost. So that meant it needed an observer. And it was also needed to supplement the reconnaissance because, of course, the big problem during all of World War II was A, finding the enemy, and B, designating the enemy accurately. So this was the mixture of doctrine requirements for the fleet fighter. And, you know, I think it was about 26, 28 months later, the first one rolled off the production line. And at that point in early to mid 1940, it was the world's very first all metal, low wing monoplane with folding wings and other technical advancements. And it wasn't the fastest, but it had useful endurance, had useful abilities in terms of its speed in a dive. It had useful maneuverability, none of which was outstanding, but you put the package together and it was able to hold off the Italians and the Germans admittedly diminishing degrees until mid-1942. And even during Operation Pedestal, when it was relegated to being the low-level interceptor against torpedo bombers, because it still had competent low-level performance, and the Hurricanes and the Wildcats were at mid and high level, it still gave more than it got. So it's just because somewhere along the line it's being compared against the likes of the Hellcat, the Corsair, and started a year after the Fulmar, but you didn't actually get a competent Wildcat until 1941, when it was finally given pilot protection, it was finally given self-sealing fuel tanks, and it was finally given folding wings. And with all that extra weight, it needed to be finally given an engine that could carry it all. So the brilliant performing Wildcat of 1939 was just not combat capable because it didn't have any of those things. By the time it had all of those things, it was no better than the Fulmar. But the difference was the Fulmar was a emergency stopgap program. It wasn't being developed. The Wildcat continued to have investment to develop its performance. So, the point is that without the Fulmar, 1941 would have been a very different story for the Royal Navy.
Yeah.
Timeliness and good enough counts is the moral of that story.
And it does. And it also makes life a lot easier when it does work. And that's the thing. I sit there and I listen to a lot of the current thinking, and everything is, I know I used the phrase jam tomorrow earlier, but everything's chasing the new shiny.
And that new shiny is always 5 years away.
Yeah. And I don't know, because we were talking about China last week, so I don't want to bring China into this too much this week, but some of the things they talk about, their recent actions with Canada, where they've basically said if Canada keeps taking refugees from Hong Kong, they're going to start taking out on Canadian citizens in China. And you go, that's not a good look. And once you start doing that to Canada, we're not talking about America or Britain, we're talking about Canada. Of the Anglosphere nations, i.e. the nations that speak English and they sort of do this sort of thing around the world, the only potentially nicer nation is New Zealand. And the only reason they can go for potentially nicer is they're even smaller and less offensive. The Canadians are... they're the nice ones. They're the ones who make the rest of the Anglosphere go, we love you, you're lovely.
They have this damned inconvenience respect for the rule of law.
It's terrible, really. Who'd have thought it? People who
shouldn't they be adopting the British real politic approach?
Britain has a real politic approach.
I don't think we have a politic at the moment.
No. At the moment, until the Alex and Drac benevolent, I'm not sure if we want to call it dictatorship, but just benevolent rule comes into place, I don't think Britain can be said to have a politics.
Well, we could always go for a triumph.
I do find it amazing that... you know,
you always go for a triumvirate if you waive the whole citizenship thing.
Oh, well, that's fine. We'll do that.
I think at the moment Britain is rapidly going towards an experiment to see if it can be like Belgium and just get along without a functioning government for a few years.
I think the trouble is our government was all set up in Britain to deal with Brexit. And it had this idea that if it just looks, this iteration of government had this idea that if it looked stronger, then the European Union would stop behaving like it has been and would actually start negotiating fairly. But they don't seem to understand that there is no such thing as fair negotiations. Both sides go out asking for the best possible deal for their side.
It's the nature of negotiations.
And then you compromise and negotiate that. Yes.
And you start off my point
the trouble
is here
is with Britain and the European Union, it's neither side has actually started going, yeah, we need to sort of go, because both wants the other side to blink first.
And this, you want to give these guys the hot seat in a fully networked armed force?
Oh, please, no.
No, we really don't. We really don't.
That's how you
toss a coin between me and Drac, okay?
Yeah. You give the politicians the keys to directing the military on a blow-by-blow basis, and at that point you hand Russia the planet, because Putin is literally the only political leader of a major country who has anything approaching military experience.
Actually, I have something better. Give the keys to the Queen.
Yeah, to be honest, the Queen would school everybody. Because you'd have Prince Philip in the background just going, right, showtime.
That's what I say. He'd go right showtime, and then she'd put him to one side and go, "No, this is my fun time. I've been doing this longer than any of them."
But remember, in classic Emperor's New Groove style, if you've seen that wonderful Disney movie, if everything goes completely to pieces, I can bet you the Queen would just be sitting there with Prince Philip at her side, just like, "Push the button, Philip." Just imagine the look on his face as well when he just flips open the box. It's just like,
oh!
And then we can all start singing Edelweiss as the missiles fall. Oh dear!
Very, very grim note to end the podcast on.
How long have we got? Have we got the use of time?
That's 58 minutes.
Oh, we got a few couple more minutes. We don't need to end the podcast quite on Prince Philip managing to blow up the world.
Well, I'm sure he'd like to.
This is what Iron Brew does to you guys.
I mean, in all seriousness, you definitely don't want politicians trying to micromanage the military. It's never worked. It's never going to work.
You don't want four-star admirals doing it either, to be honest.
And this gives them the ability. This gives them the ability from Whitehall or the Pentagon to decide what the lower mess decks on HMS Bulwark are going to have for dinner on Sunday night.
Yeah. Which, if that's not going to be a way to cause a mutiny, I don't know what is. Yeah, it's as I say, it's one of these things which sounds good on paper, but you're in the catch 22 of, if it's going to work, it's going to work in a situation where you don't need it, and when you need it, it's almost certainly not going to work, because someone's going to be doing their level best to break it. And that is assuming, of course, that it bucks the trend of most military programs and isn't built by the lowest bidder in the first place, and so just is broken out of the box.
But is this turning real combat into the ultimate computer game, where you have someone sitting at a nice big console, you know, in their comfy air-conditioned office, pointing and clicking on these icons and saying, you know, pew pew pew, move your ship, move this ship there, move that ship there, move this aircraft there. You know, basically playing, you know, civilization.
It wouldn't be that complicated.
I'm just imagining like a little version of Microsoft's Clippy showing up. It's like, it looks like you're trying to run a war from 3,000 miles away with a 5-second time lag. Would you like some help with that? But I mean, to be honest, actually, weirdly enough, it could actually force a completely different line of kind of naval arms race, kind of a naval communications and sensors arms race, which to a certain extent we've kind of been in already, but it could, the first Navy to achieve full network status is probably going to kick off a network and counter network arms race, the likes of which we've never seen before. So all of a sudden jamming technology will take a massive leap forward, because let's face it,
the Royal Navy, they're the only ones who still invest heavily in that.
Yeah, I was going to say, like most armed forces, generally, most of their jamming tech is older than I am.
There are two nations in the world which invest, organizations which invest in it in the world. There's the Russian army, which has all sorts of fancy modern gear, and there's the Royal Navy, which is gear is all officially still has the names of the older stuff, but if they spend as much money as they officially do, according to the accounts which are publicly available, that are the ones on it, I don't think you're spending that much money. Just keep repeating the old one.
That money's not being redirected towards the dining table or the chauffeur.
The Royal Navy wishes it was. If the admirals could get away with it, they would be, but they couldn't.
But the interesting sort of counterfactual to it is that if all of a sudden everyone's now investing in jamming, hacking, blocking, disruption technology, then we could actually see... I almost want to take an inspiration from Star Wars. Well, Star Wars, as it was explained before Disney took over, but... and this will test some people.
That was before Disney?
Yeah, there was.
Tell me more about this hallowed great time.
But one of the explanations, I mean, okay, it was a post fact justification, but one of the big justifications that was written into Star Wars canon as to why all their ships fought at point blank range when they're in faster than light spacecraft and should realistically be fighting from hundreds of thousands of kilometers away, was that yes, everyone had these fancy sensors, and yes, everyone had these fancy targeting systems, but everyone also had massive amounts of electronic warfare and jamming equipment, which knocked all of the other guy's sensors back to a range at which you might as well just fire using optical sights and basic onboard hardened targeting systems that were simple and tough enough that they couldn't be jammed. And so everyone ended up fighting at point blank range anyway, even though they technically had the ability to fight miles and miles away. And you could end up with that kind of scenario developing, because let's face it, if you've developed a technology that can cripple the communications of a fleet when you've got a ship that can generate many megawatts of power and its communication systems are jammed, you've also invented a jamming technology that can pretty much break any link between launching craft and missile, probably do a nasty number to active homing missiles, any data links between aircraft, data links between other forms of weaponry, at which point all of a sudden a lot of the capabilities that we take for granted now, like the fact that if a missile appears over the horizon you can engage it, you might not be able to if there's a massive great jammer sat there blaring away that means your radar will only function at about 5 kilometers, at which point
how long do you think it would take to reactivate HMS Victory?
Once they finish their refit, probably a few years, a couple of years. I mean, there was a few big holes in the hull which they would have to plug again. But it's in surprisingly
probably
good
HMS
shape.
Warrior would be more quickly.
Yeah, that's
done.
That is actually mobile. Well, it's floating. Put it that way. Don't know about mobile.
We need to put in some new engines, but we could do that.
Yeah, but I mean,
give me in track a few weeks.
It does raise a serious possibility, though, that if
don't ask who's paying the bill.
if you are going to end up with a fully networked fleet, the kind of technology you'd have to develop to jam that, and anyone who wanted to fight fully networked fleet would have to be investing in that tech, would incidentally also have invented a technology capable of knocking out long-range lock-on guidance and communication systems of most modern weaponry as well, which suddenly means everyone's back to fighting within visual range.
HMS Vanguard, the battleship, shall return!
The Americans are going to be looking at the Iowas and going, okay, now exactly how much is it going to cost us to replace the engines?
Well, it worked.
Yeah.
But this is the problem. We're falling into the historian trap here, guys. We're falling into the good old days.
Well, I
call the Iowas good old days. I've seen their crew accommodations in pictures.
To be honest, actually, it could actually bring the era of laser weapons to the fore, because after all, the laser weapon is a line of sight weapon. It's very fast acting, much faster acting than a shell. The main weakness of it compared to a missile is that you can't fire it at targets over the horizon unless you've got a very cooperative, very large mirror hanging in space. But if everyone's forced to fight at visual range anyway, then all of a sudden packing a gigantic laser and or railgun on your ship suddenly becomes a very viable option, which would lead to some very weird naval fights, because considering that the vast majority of lasers are invisible to the naked eye, they're not classic sci-fi like red and green beams and everything.
Do you mean we're not going to be able to tell Romulans from Klingons firing at us?
Unfortunately not.
Drak, you're crushing me now. You're crushing me.
But it does lead to, I just wonder if somebody, like, a broadside fight between two massively laser-equipped ships is basically going to look like two ships sailing next to each other, and then suddenly one of them explodes.
Or bits and pieces just constantly falling off of them.
Yeah, just start melting, as if the ship's made of it's like an oddly coloured snow ship on a summer's day.
And at that point, you have to wonder, do your ships end up starting to look like a mirror ball?
Yes, I was going to say that.
Mm.
Yeah,
playing 70s disco music.
Yeah.
I'm just daring with the, instead of on the Samson radar, just got a giant disco ball to reflect incoming lasers.
Oh.
I guess this is the other thing, is, you know, the passive technology is also advancing quite dramatically as well. You've got radar systems now that don't rely on emitters. They just use commercial grade radios that are already pumping out signals. And so, you know, along comes a vessel or a vehicle, and it's got its receivers there driving along, just using the background radiation to get the information it needs. So, I guess, you know, if you can pump some sort of useful radiation over the horizon, then, you know, you probably can have those ships without that their own emitters broadcasting their own location. But once again, though, you have a central node that is an obvious target.
Could even bring the full age of the submarine, because there aren't any capabilities on a submarine you can delete. And a submarine is going to be the hardest of all the things to integrate into the networked battle fleet, A, because of it needs to be very stealthy, and B, because large bodies of water really don't play very well with most forms of communication systems, certainly not high data traffic ones. At which point, if everyone on the surface is reduced to basically fixing bayonets, now the submarine is king.
Is it, though? Because if you're doing this much, you know, we're talking about this level of jamming technology.
Mm.
If I'm developing this level of jamming technology, and I'm a less than scrupulous power, or don't have to deal with Greenpeace, would I not try and develop a version of that technology that works on below the surface? If I'm developing such technology which is going to create so much jamming, so much noise, that missiles will not be able to home in on me, why would I not try and use a variation of that technology to try and work on torpedoes and make some mariners' lives hell?
Could do, but considering most of the jamming depth you're doing underwater would be sound-based, it would be a bit of a different technological tree to go down, I guess, because you can build a big radio antenna and just start pumping out all sorts of wonderful electronic emissions very easily. But pretty much the only way you're going to be disrupting submarines and torpedoes would be effectively sticking a bunch of giant speakers on the underside of your submarines, or your ship will start blasting dubstep or something. Which, if you're doing
AC/DC?
It loud,
could be.
At that point, it's your things. At that point, A, you're advertising yourself very, very loudly to anyone who can build a simple home on very loud sound torpedo, which they'd figured out in the World War II. And two, even if it gets to the point that you're putting out so much energy that you're able to physically disrupt the workings of the torpedo and the submarines, you can still fire things in a straight line. All the torpedo can just be set to, in case of failure of sensor, vector along straight line along most recent path. And again, that worked in World War II. Ships haven't gotten spectacularly faster or more agile. You could, certainly. I mean, especially if you're willing to write off the environmental implications of blasting the ocean with hundreds of decibels of sound. But it would be a lot tougher to pull off than jamming electronic communications.
Andy would, of course, be really. It would be a remake for a really bad version of the Free Willy movies.
I think the upshot of all of this is let's just forget the whole fighting thing. It's way too expensive, way too complicated. Let's all just go back to banging the rocks together and climbing trees.
Well, yeah, I think it comes down to the simple paradigm of the more complex something is, the easier it is to break. And there's enough issues getting ships to work. I mean, it's always been the case. Every time you introduce a new level of complexity, the more things break, the more things need refitting. I mean, you look at the Age of Sail. You could send a ship out and it could disappear over the horizon for 10 years. And when it came back, haul it up, careen it, scrape off the infinite barnacles that have probably fetched up on it at that point, replace a few rotten timbers, and you basically can put the ship back out to sea. These days, at the other end of the technological spectrum, some of the more recent US Navy ships that have been coming back into port have been breaking continuous at-sea records because they didn't want to catch COVID, and they've been out for 200 plus days. I can't remember the exact figures, but it's something in the 200s. And that's not even a year. A 1 year deployment for an Age of Sail warship would have been considered short. Whereas a slightly less than,
considered heavenly.
Yeah, a slightly less than 1 year deployment for a modern ship is considered absolutely remarkable. And now the ship's going to go into dry dock because there's an awful lot of stuff that needs fixing. And it's been trending that way down. Sort of trended, the time has been trending down as ships get more complex. It's just add another layer of complexity. And as I say, more things to break, more things to go wrong, more opportunities for the enemy to get in. If it works, great, fantastic, extra lethality. But you're going to have to invest an awful lot of money and an awful lot of time to make sure it actually does work and is not as easy to break as it probably will be.
And continuing on Jamie's theme, there was that old quote, which was that one of the generals said to a president, I think it was, "I know not what weapons will fight World War III, but I know World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones." Mm. And the more I think about this, the more I think it's getting the wrong. It's getting superstar billing, and it really shouldn't be. I agree with your earlier point. This is a natural evolution of a communication system. And as long as they don't, the fact they keep calling it, they're saying it's a Manhattan Project and this sort of stuff. I'm not sure whether it's the current tendency to just go for hubris. Every time we're announcing something, it's got to be a moonshot. It's got to be a this has got to be a that, because if it isn't, then it just isn't going to get any coverage. And if it gets no coverage, that's a bad thing. Mm. You know, you've got to hype everything up the whole time. And it's just not, that's not good.
No, but we shall see. I mean, we could all be wrong, and to be perfectly honest, it'd be great to be wrong.
We would love to be wrong.
If they can make it work, it'd be fantastic. It's just that, shall we say, history is not on their side when it comes to this kind of thing.
History, and we are, humanity.
At the end of the day, we are historians, so we're probably going to be taking history aside.
Yeah, so we're
probably history. It's not just history. I mean, history, as we all know, doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme. So writers are also involved in this whole process.
Mm. Yeah. And there is the fact that this is another large-scale government IT project.
Oh, no. Right, we're doomed. If it's a large-scale government IT project, that means it's going to come in 3 times over budget, 5 years late, and its first activation, somehow the network cable will gain sentience and reach out and strangle its operator.
Because listen to the actual phrase. It says, I'm confident that closing this risk is dependent on enhanced distributed maritime operations for a teamed, manned, unmanned force that exploits artificial intelligence and machine learning. So it's not just communications.
Well, no, the communications enables all those other things. That was partly my point, is that, you know, as Drak warns, it becomes the absolute core of the whole system. And without it, it doesn't work.
Yes, but this is Project Overmatch, which will develop networks, infrastructure, data architecture, tools, and analytics that will support the operational development environment that will enable our sustained maritime dominance. This is a large government IT project. This is not just about the communications. This is about all the stuff which is going to make those communications work. And to deal with all that data is requiring a lot of computers. And we've been over the data, the problem, the communication side, but there's also going to be a whole lot of data and computing issues. I refer you to my earlier point about the F-35. Haven't we just all been through this for that?
Well, hopefully we've learned from that.
We can hope. We can hope.
We live in hope, but...
We live in hope.
Hope for the best, prepare for the worst, and you're never disappointed.
Yeah. So, am I the only one who's now going to start looking into building a bunker in my back garden after seeing that?
I'm just going to nail all my network cables to the floor. I'm watching you. I'm getting ahead of the curve.
Oh, God.
Just make sure you tie that toaster down.
Yeah.
You're worried about the toaster. I'm worried about the frickin' microwave.
Well, it's when I go to put the King's Mill in, and I start seeing a little red light just going. Vroom, 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 vroom. That's when you really know things have gone south.
Oh, good lord!
Yeah. Anyway, I think that's probably our time now.
It's probably our time. So I will say thank you to the crew, because, as always, it's fun. The next one after this, as I said, will have Steve George, who will hopefully answer some questions on Falklands War from me and Drak, and F-35 from Jamie.
Well, we've always asked him about what he thinks of these network solutions.
Oh, mm-hmm. That could be fun, because he is a very, very good engineer, but he's also used to dealing with humans. And, yeah, that's hopefully going to start kicking off a bit of a Falklands War theme for the next few weeks, which you'll hear more about next week.
Because we're determined to fight the last war all over again. Brought to you by three historians.
To an extent, but also we are determined that actually the lessons of the Falklands War should actually be remembered, and The trouble is, every time I see people talking about Lessons of War, they seem to skip over the Falklands War, as it's rather inconvenient, as things happen which are not great. And a lot of issues are come up with it.
Yes.
Yeah, they always seem to be referring to World War II, and they sort of start going about this long-range amphibious operations. Well, let's talk about the island hopping campaign in World War II. And I'm sort of going, there was one operation which was about an 8,000-mile distance. I think that might have the record for a long-range contested amphibious operations. I think possibly 8,000 miles to go to a contested place could be the record. I'm not sure. There might have been a few more in the age of, you know, Empire. And, of course, there was Operation Ironclad. But that really sort of launched from Cape Town in many respects. So, yeah. It's fun.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Arch. Thank you, Arch. Take care.
See you later.
See ya.
Bye.
Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.